for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The United Nations turned 70 this year. The set of challenges it faces today are quite different from those it was created to address. These include climate change, global pandemics such as Ebola, and the threat of violent extremism. With me to discuss how the UN is confronting the crises of today and preparing for conflicts of tomorrow, David Bosco of American University, Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, and Brett Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation. Joining us by phone from New York, Somini Sengupta of the New York Times. I invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here.
And Somini Sengupta, if I could start with you. You wrote that the war in Syria has tarnished the image of the UN. Talk about why.
Yeah, hi. The world watched the crisis in Syria escalate and escalate, and the humanitarian crisis get worse and worse, and the chaos spread across the region. And for 4 years, the Security Council has been unable to come to any sort of agreement to do any of three things: to make to address the humanitarian crisis, to bring the warring sides to the table and hammer out a peace deal, or to address what are clearly atrocities, mass atrocities taking place. So on all three counts, I wrote a couple of weeks ago that the Security Council, which is made of the world's powers, have failed on all three.
David Bosco, do you see that as a fair assessment?
I do. I mean, in many respects, this was the kind of crisis that the founders of the UN imagined it dealing with, because it's not just a horrific internal conflict. It's also one that is creating deep instability in the region, spawning conflict elsewhere. And the Security Council has the powers it needs. You know, the UN Charter makes quite clear that it can use coercive measures if necessary to deal with threats to the peace. But I think one distinction we need to keep in mind is when we talk about the UN, we have to be clear about what aspect of the system is failing. And as Somini pointed out, the Security Council has been unable to act because of disagreement, sharp disagreement between its permanent members. That is quite different from saying, for example, that the UN bureaucracy or the UN aid agencies aren't working. And many of them are doing important work in and around Syria. So that's something we have to keep in mind.
So, Mini, how would you respond?
Absolutely. I think that distinction we have to keep that in mind. However, to a large degree, the UN humanitarian agencies can only do so much. So unless the world powers, chiefly those who have influence over the Syrian government, press the Syrian government to open up the borders and let in aid convoys, then aid doesn't get in. So, the world powers have a role to play in even that. Having said that, I think it's worth bearing in mind that there are millions of refugees and displaced people who rely on the UN and aid agencies for water, food, shelter, some semblance of schooling. So, there are things that the UN can do, and the UN aid, the humanitarian system, is very much stretched thin, not just in Syria, but in all the other conflicts that they have to deal with around the world.
And Phyllis Bennis, the World Health Organization's handling of Ebola was another area where the UN came under a lot of criticism.
It did, and I think it's very much in this context of what do we mean when we criticize the UN? It's always a tricky one because for many people in the U.S. in particular, the knowledge about what the World Health Organization or UNICEF or the UN's Refugee Organization or any of the myriad of humanitarian or development organizations are doing is simply not there. And people see the UN, excuse me, is what happens at the Security Council. So in this case, the failure of the WHO to really assert leadership has everything to do with does that agency get the kind of support it needs? Does it get funding? And, of course, funding for the UN is always a political football in the U.S., despite the fact that much of it is required dues that's based on each country's share of the global economy. You know, it's based on the notion that it's just as difficult for the U.S. to pay. I think our overall dues is somewhere about $1.2 billion a year to the U.N. It's about 25% of the U.N.'s budget, 22%, sorry, 22. Of the U.N. budget. And that reflects the fact that our overall economy is about 22%, it's actually more, of the world's economy. And similarly, if you look at Chad or Cameroon or the poorest countries in the world, their share of the dues is maybe $10,000. And it's as difficult for them to come up with that as for us to come up with a billion. So if we don't provide the additional funding, whether it's for the WHO, they can't do their job. If we don't provide political support for the leadership of the WHO, they can't do their job.
And to you, Brett Schaefer, what lessons do you take away, say, from the Ebola crisis?
Well, I think, of course, the UN does important work in a lot of different areas. And the World Health Organization does good work in a number of different areas as well. But what we saw in that case is a problem that is not uncommon in the UN system, where you have the accumulation of mandates and responsibilities that have been placed upon the organization by the member states over years. Seldom do they take a look at those responsibilities, those mandates, and reassess whether they're still relevant or necessary in today's date. So you have an accumulation of responsibilities that stress the finances and the capabilities of the organization. And oftentimes, the emphasis of where the organization should put its resources don't necessarily reflect the unique capabilities of the organization at stake. In today's world, it's very, very different than the world that the World Health Organization was established in. The World Health Organization was actually sort of the successor of a organization, the health organization that was created under the League of Nations. So you can go back even further than that. But the world today, UN, the World Health Organization budget is about $2 billion per year. The U.S. global health budget alone is $9 billion. The Gates Foundation makes $3 billion a year in grants. You have an enormous number of NGOs and other private organizations that are operating around the world in a way that was unimaginable 60, 70 years ago. And so when you take a look at what the health organization did, they were saw the Ebola outbreak through a political lens. They delayed the announcement of an emergency that has been widely condemned in a way that I think led to deaths that were avoidable. And we have a situation that is far more tragic than it probably had to be because of the politicized nature of WHO and the misallocation of the resources that are provided to it.
Would you agree with that, David Bosco?
I think there were some clear problems in the way that the WHO responded, and it does seem that part of it was based on a hesitation about confronting the governments there, because some of the governments wanted to wait on declaring an emergency, and it sounds like the WHO acquiesced to that to some degree. So I think there's an element of fairness there, and I think that I think that the question of accountability of UN officials and UN decision makers is something that's very important. And we need to keep that in mind, not just about, for example, the Ebola outbreak, but if you look at the peacekeeping failures of the 1990s, there were some real bad decisions there made by UN officials. And the organization has not always been very good about examining and holding accountable its own officials. And so the one area where I would disagree a bit with Phyllis is that I think it's not just a question of funding the organization more. It's a question of ensuring that we have good decision makers who get held accountable for
choices. Hasn't the U.S. for at least the last year withheld some funding?
The U.S., well, there is some funding that the U.S., in the order of several billion dollars, that's kind of arrears. But those have been longstanding based on a dispute over some funding for Palestinian issues. The Obama administration, though, cleared a large portion of arrears early on. And so the U.N. would say the U.S. still owes money. I think the U.S. might dispute some of that.
All right. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, I want to ask you all about the Security Council, something that is constantly both in the news and in dispute. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that every business is in the software business. CA software and services work to help companies optimize their digital transformation in the application economy. More information is at ca.com. And from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses succeed with email and online marketing tools. For organizations to promote their business through newsletters, events, surveys, and social media. More at ConstantContact.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about how the UN is operating, whether it's doing its job, whether it's living up to current expectations. I want to go back to you, Soumini Sengupta, reporter for The New York Times. A perennial issue here is the makeup of the Security Council. Their renewed calls for reforms. What's wrong with how it operates, and how do you see it?
Thanks. I'm going to actually address your question, and then I'm going to have to jump off because there is a lot going on at the Security Council today. But one thing I wanted to mention is here's the main question facing the UN system, including chiefly the Security Council. Is the United Nations there to express the will of the international community and solve shared problems, whether that's Syria or climate change or Ebola, or will it let the interests of national governments prevail, whether that's the interests of world powers prevailing over, you know, their allies, or whether it's, you know, the will of national governments in not declaring a public health emergency? when it comes to Ebola. So that's a built-in tension. Whether or not the Security Council is expanded to reflect, you know, the current state of the world, that built-in tension will be there. And that's something that I think is holding up action both on the Security Council in several of the agencies in the UN system.
All right, and Samini Sengupta, thank you for joining us today. We'll talk to you another time.
Thank you.
And David Bosco, how do you respond to her concerns about the Security Council?
Yeah, I think that was an interesting way of phrasing it, and I think that's the way that a lot of people think about the UN, which is, can we get states who make up the UN to think beyond their national interest? I think that's very hard. I think it's very hard to ask governments to not pursue or to somehow act against their national interest. And so what we really have on the Security Council then is, for example, on Syria, very different perceptions of the crisis, very different perceptions of the political solution there.
But let's talk about first the makeup. Mm-hmm. The five permanent members with veto powers, the 10 non-permanent members.
Right. And this is something that I think critics of the UN system often focus on, which is we have the same five permanent members that we had in 1945 when the UN began operating. And so a country like Brazil or a Germany or an India and Japan says, how can this be? We're enormous funders of the organization and we deserve permanent seats. The dilemma in terms of council reform is that in order to get reform, you have to have the acquiescence of the five current permanent members, and almost as difficult, you have to have the support of two-thirds of the rest of the UN membership to get any plan through. And there is a lot of disagreement among the broader UN membership about how to expand the council, how to reform it. And so, you know, if you, for example, you want to put Brazil on there, there are some countries in Latin America that will have strong views that Brazil should not be the country that gets a permanent seat.
Phyllis.
You know, I think this goes back, Diane, to the founding of the United Nations. It was founded very much to reflect the interests of the victors of World War II. They were the five, the big five, the permanent five, the nuke five, all these five powerful countries. You know, arguably, I think Britain and France are probably the most likely to hold on to their perks because otherwise they would be the least likely to be considered global powers at this point. But what we have is a scenario where the conflict between power and democracy in the UN is centered on this challenge between the Security Council, arguably the least democratic component of the UN, and the General Assembly, arguably the most democratic, which has relatively far less power. It does have some power that it doesn't use, it doesn't claim, and could if it had a different kind of collective political will. But I do think that this question, the issue of UN reform and who, which countries are present, is really crucial. But I think it is important that we not view it in the context of our countries, all countries, willing to act against their own interests. The question is how governments define their own interests. Madeleine Albright was the one who said overtly, the UN is a tool of American foreign policy, which was a rather shocking thing, for even if they believe it, for a former UN ambassador and then a Secretary of State to say overtly. You know, I think that's the problem that we have in the U.S. is this issue of how do we define it? If we define it as a tool of our foreign policy, we're not going to allow it and support its independent role in the world.
So, Brett, the first issue then is representation, but then the second issue is veto. These five countries, and only one country has to veto.
Well, it's interesting that that comment by Madeleine Albright. I would defy you to find any nation that didn't think the United Nations is a venue for advancing their own national interests or a tool to advance those interests. Because every country, even if you're the smallest country, you take a look at the UN General Assembly, you take a look at the countries that vie for positions on the Security Council, they do that to try and create a platform or take advantage of the global platform that is the UN to promote, to bring attention to try and address issues of concern to them. And you see this over and over and over again. In essence, the General Assembly is sort of like a a log rolling society where countries come together to I'll scratch your back if you scratch my back in order to advance joint issues of concern. And so it's a very political body, and I don't think you can separate the governments from the politics. On the issue of Security Council reform and expansion, when we talk about reform in the United Nations, in the United States, we often talk about financial issues, accountability, transparency, effectiveness of the United Nations. And we do that for a particular reason. As Phyllis mentioned earlier, we fund 22% of the UN regular budget, and we fund 28.4% of the peacekeeping budget. When you add all that together, the two different budgets together, the U.S. pays more than $3 billion to the United Nations for those two budgets alone. On an annual basis, we pay close to $8 billion to the UN system. When you take a look at the countries that are assessed the least amount, and for the regular budget, that would be 0.001%, and for peacekeeping, 0.0001%. All told, those countries charged the least amount are only paying about $36,000. So when you take a look at the United States' financial obligations to the organization at $3 billion and the least assessed countries at about $36,000, you're talking about a very disparate attention and focus on financial matters because we have a lot of skin in the game. We have a lot of commitments there. And when you take a look at these other countries, they don't have nearly the same kind of commitments. So the idea of effectiveness of the UN is much more prominent from America's perspective than it is from many of these other countries.
Tell us.
But in terms of the Security Council, they focus on Security Council as the effort of their reform because they see it as an opportunity to promote their prominence in international circles. And so when we talk about Security Council reform in the UN, talk about expansion of the Security Council. Well, we were talking just earlier how difficult it is to get the UN to do, UN Security Council to act effectively on Syria, on Ukraine, on any number of issues around the world. But when you add more people to the pool, if you expand the Security Council to 26 or 27 members, particularly if you add new members with new vetoes, that process becomes exponentially more difficult. And so if you want the Security Council to be even less effective than it would be in addressing a lot of these crises, I think the answer would be to expand the Security Council and particularly to grant vetoes to new permanent members.
I think that it's very important when we talk about, you use the term, Brett, the least assessed. Those happen to be the least wealthy countries. We're talking about the poorest countries, and I would really dispute the idea that they don't have, as you put it, skin in the game. These are the countries that are far more dependent on the UN's agencies for the basics of human life in many ways, for assistance in building wells, in creating an electrical infrastructure, all of those things that we don't depend on the United Nations for. So I think that's very different. I also think that we have to get into a global mindset when we look at the question of what does it mean to say that the Security Council or the UN as a whole is or is not effective. The term effective in the United States is always used to mean does it support what we want the UN to do, which is almost always to endorse a military solution in the Security Council where there are these disputes. If I would assert that one of the most effective periods of the UN's life in modern history was the 8-month period in the run-up to the war in Iraq, when you had a Security Council completely divided, where you had what Rumsfeld dismissively called old Europe opposed to the war, led by France and Germany, and you had what became known as the uncommitted six very, well, some poor and some middle-income countries, but countries traditionally very dependent on keeping good relations with the United States. They were Angola, Cameroon, Guinea, Mexico, Chile, Pakistan. None of these countries would traditionally go head-to-head with the U.S. They depended too much on U.S. support, financial and political support. And yet none of those countries were willing to vote to support the war, partly because they were engaged with a public in their own countries that was massively mobilized to oppose the war. And that engagement of the U.N. with that broad social movement, I think, was one of the most effective moments of U.N. history.
So David Husko, what would it mean to expand that Security Council to, say, 25 countries?
Well, I think a lot of it would depend on how the expansion was done and, as Brett pointed out, whether you gave new members the veto power. My view is that's very, very unlikely that we would have new veto-wielding members. I think the most likely solution, and others have proposed this as well, is that you expand the council by about five and you add a category of what you might call quasi-permanent members who can serve, for example, five-year terms, get reelected immediately if they win enough support. That might give an outlet for a country like a Brazil or an India or a Japan to essentially be serving on the council on a nearly permanent basis. And if you added to that a couple of new non-permanent seats, that is, I think, a package deal that might be able to get through, to get over the very high hurdles to amending the UN Charter.
But, you know, even when the Security Council does pass something, a resolution, how likely is it that it's going to get carried out?
Yes, that's a big question. There are a lot of resolutions that are not enforced. But I think we need to have a little bit of a historical perspective here. And I think, you know, along the lines that Phyllis was suggesting, we need to remember that the UN system is much more active right now than it has been ever in its history. For much of the Cold War, the UN was essentially paralyzed. You have almost 130,000 UN peacekeepers now out in places like Mali, Central African Republic, Lebanon, doing work that is difficult, that is sometimes controversial, but I think is quite important. And it's not as if we are in a world where the UN is simply paralyzed. So we have to keep things like Syria and Ukraine in perspective. We are talking about a UN and a Security Council that is, you know, in historical terms, in a very active phase of its existence.
David Bosco is assistant professor at American University. He is the author of a book titled Five, To Rule Them All, A History of the UN Security Council. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Frank in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Okay, so I'd like to make two points. One of them is when you compare the GDP of other countries to how much money they give to the United Nations than compared to the United States, I bet you it would be a lot different. And when we signed on to the United Nations, that became part of our Constitution. And when we made violations to it, we made violations to the Constitution. And I think that some of our representatives should be held accountable for things like that.
Now, how do you see that, Brett?
Well, getting to the second point first, just ratifying a treaty doesn't amend our Constitution. It's just under the Constitution, ratification of a treaty becomes law of the land, the same as any other statute. Congress can pass a law that violates that treaty. Now, that is not considered kosher in international law, but that is nonetheless the way our system works. And in terms of withholding, the United States actually wasn't the first or the second or even the 100th country to withhold money from the United Nations. If you go back to the 1960s, there were two UN peacekeeping operations, UNEF and UNOC, those peacekeeping operations were very controversial at the time. A number of countries in the developing world and the Soviet Union and in Europe as well decided to withhold money from the United Nations to finance those operations. And in those days, peacekeeping didn't have a separate budget. It was part of the regular budget. This created a huge financial crisis in the organization. And the U.S. actually had to bail the United Nations out to keep it going, in essence, providing a loan for the organization. At that time, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Arthur Goldberg, a former member of the Supreme Court, made a statement which is known as the Goldberg Reservation, which said, and I'll quote him here, "If any member can insist on making an exception to the principle of collective financial responsibility with respect to certain activities of the organization, the United States reserves the same option to make exceptions to the principles of collective financial responsibility if, in our view, strong and compelling reasons exist for doing so. There can be no double standard among the members of the organization." So this is a standard, a reservation that the U.S. put in place at the time, and we've exercised it when we thought that the issue was serious enough to merit U.S. withholding going forward.
Brett, would you like to see a dissolution of the UN?
No, I don't. I think the UN serves a very valuable purpose, and I think in a lot of ways that the organization is very effective in certain key areas. What I would like to see is frequent reassessment of the activities and the responsibilities that are put upon the organization up in New York, peacekeeping operations, and also in other funds and programs and specialized agencies. I think that that reevaluation doesn't occur frequently enough, and I think that every nation should do this on a periodic basis to assess where their contributions are being used most effectively.
All right. And try and reform it. Would you like to see the U.S. reduce its contribution to the UN?
You reduce its contribution to the UN?
Yeah.
I think that we should be, in terms of UN peacekeeping, under U.S. law right now, we have a cap of 25% on peacekeeping.
All right.
I think we should be doing that.
I'll stop you right there. Short break. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate from high school prepared for success in college and career, and supporting innovation that can improve public schools at gatesfoundation.org. From Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors, on the web at pamm.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Do you even know when you're lying anymore, or is it just like blinking?
What do you want, Raylan?
Justified is heading toward the final showdown. The FX series is concluding its sixth and final season. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Justified's creator and showrunner, Graham Yost. Join us.
Welcome back. We're talking about the United Nations, its current operations, its past successes and failures, and indeed its future. Let's go now to Larry in Wichita, Kansas. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, panel.
Hello.
Happy to be here. Listen to you all the time.
Thanks.
Quick question. Kind of listening to the panel, and it seems to me that is this concern, maybe among the panel members, that increasing the UN Security Council membership would not be good for the United States, or something inherently, how could I say it? You know, maybe not acceptable, if you will. Why do I feel that? I'm trying to hear the panel's point of view, and I shut up now. Thank you.
Well, I think there's a
there's a real debate that goes on within the U.S. government about whether Security Council reform would be in its interests. And, you know, formally the U.S. says, yes, we'd like to see, you know, India there. We'd like to see some other countries there. I would say they're not putting a lot of time and effort into galvanizing the process because, you know, frankly, the United States has a very good situation here. And I just parenthetically, it's interesting that, you know, there's a lot of skepticism and hostility to the UN in the U.S., but from the rest of the world's perspective, they look at the U.S. position at the UN and they say, you have an enormously privileged position. You have the veto power. How can, you know, you have so many complaints and concerns about the UN when we don't have that power?
What do you think there is so much hostility toward the UN right now, Brett?
Well, it's interesting you, David, mentioned that. It's not a new phenomenon. If you go back and you look at what Gallup has done in terms of public polling over the years, they first began asking the question on a regular basis in 1970, and the question is very simple. It's, do you think the UN is doing a good job with the responsibilities that have been assigned to it? And the average over that time since 1970 was that 38% believe that the UN is not doing a good job, is doing actually a poor job. And 38% believe that the UN is doing a good job, and 52% on average say that the UN has been doing a poor job. Only twice in that entire time has the UN been over 50% in terms of doing a good job, and that was in 1990 and 1993. Not coincidentally, that was right before the Gulf War when there was a lot of support for U.S. action, and right after the Gulf War when there was a lot of appreciation for UN support in that effort. So I think a lot of the U.S. opinion to the organization is tied into whether they think that the organization itself supports U.S. interests and U.S. activities around the world. And most of the time, I think the general perception is that that support isn't as robust as it should be.
We should point out that's about three times the approval rating of the U.S. Congress at this point.
Good point, Phyllis. Well,
just one point on the polls. I think that there was a period in the 80s when anti-UN sentiment was very, very high in the U.S. It was all the mythology about the black helicopters were coming and the U.N. was going to take over U.S. government, that sort of thing. And it turned out that was the position going on in Congress. There was a great deal of congressional opposition to the UN, and the polling did not reflect it. And when they did an in-depth poll in the 10 districts of the 10 most anti-UN members of Congress, they found that even there was no real difference with the national support for the UN, which was quite strong at that time. I do think that we have to keep in mind when we look at the issue of U.S. power at the UN that's sometimes recognized, sometimes not, it goes way beyond the veto. And that's one of the important things. There's something at the UN that old UN hands call the Yemen precedent that happened in 1990 when George Bush the First was trying to get support from the Security Council for going to war against Iraq in what turned out to be 1991. And in that effort, he wanted to get a consensus in the Security Council. And there were bribes and threats going on. China was bribed at the last minute not to veto as it had threatened. Yemen was one of only two countries to vote no. And no sooner had the Yemeni ambassador put down his hand than the U.S. ambassador stood next to him and said, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. Hmm. And the remark was picked up on an open mic, which many people said, oh, God, that's so embarrassing. He should have known the mic was open. I actually don't think it was an accident. I think he knew the mic was open because I think at that time nobody cared very much about Yemen. It was not a situation like we have today. And the U.S. did cut its entire aid budget to Yemen. But in the meantime, the message went out, if you cross us in the U.N. on something important to us, you will pay a price.
All right, let's go to Tony and Janice, CEO, New York.
Good morning. I like the U.N., and I think I largely agree with the sentiment of the panel. But in regard to the change, or changing the UN or making it better, I think that we need to take the lead. You know, change starts with yourself. Everyone in the Security Council has their own axe to grind, and we voted against France and England when they were voting in favor of Palestinian issues. So it's very difficult for us to complain or to get people to change in regard to things like Ukraine and Syria if we don't act in a benevolent fashion ourselves, and I wish we would start doing that if we really wanted to change.
What do you think, David?
I think the issue of Israel and Palestine is one of the central issues when you talk about the complicated relationship between the U.S. and the U.N. And if you look at vetoes, the U.S. has actually used the veto power since the early 1970s more than the other members of the Permanent Five. And it has, I think, in the majority of cases, been about Israel-Palestine. And votes in the General Assembly are always lopsided, and the U.S. is always in a minority there. And so I think the U.S. isolation, relative isolation, on Israeli issues is one of the central features of U.S. dissatisfaction with the U.N. The U.S. view is, has been, this may be changing now, that the Security Council is not the proper place to deal with Israel-Palestine issues. They should be through bilateral negotiations. I think the rest of the world says, why isn't the Security Council the right place? This is what kind of what it's for. And so I think in abstract terms, it's hard to defend the U.S. position that the Security Council shouldn't have a role in this crisis.
All right, to Juan Carlos in Orlando, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, Diane. I was telling your associate who took the call that I was very gratified by the tone and the level of the discussion on the issue of the United Nations, for which I worked for almost 30 years. I'm retired now. A little bit surprised, though, that the issue of the selection of a Secretary General has not been brought to the discussion. And I would like to call this to your attention because I think it's an issue that deserves discussion and deserves, more importantly, change in how it's in how it happens.
Talk about how you believe the selection process should be changed, Juan Carlos.
Well, I think it should be much more transparent, much more open. I think that member states should look into merit and not so much into the politics of who needs to be selected according to geographical region or closeness to one of the powers in the Security Council. We've had tremendous secretary generals throughout the years, starting with Dag Hammarskjöld and Trygve Lie. But frankly, there's much to be desired when a new Secretary General comes to, or the name for a new Secretary General comes to the front, and how it was selected and what's behind it. I think it's something that needs discussion. I think it's something that merits discussion because, after all, he who leads the United Nations, it's going to be decisive in the future of that organization.
Indeed. Thank you so much for your call, Phyllis.
You know, I think that Juan Carlos raises a very important point, and we see this over and over again, the combination of the insistence on a regional basis for selecting this the next Secretary General always narrows it, and the level of transparency is virtually non-existent. So we know of examples when Madeleine Albright was the Secretary of State, for example, at the United Nations. She made her campaign to prevent a second term for Boutros-Boutros-Ghali the centerpiece of her campaign to become Secretary of State. And that campaign worked. She actually said, when she was asked by a journalist, would you support anyone else instead of Boutros-Ghali? And she said, anyone else. And the follow-up was, would you support Salim Salim, who famously had danced in the aisles of the General Assembly when China was admitted instead of Taiwan and was seen as a great opponent of U.S. policies? She said, I would even vote for Salim Salim over Boutros-Ghali. When Boutros-Ghali had done a very good job as in his first term, but that kind of individual campaigning and backroom pressure is still a huge problem at the United Nations.
Brett.
Well, it's interesting because the process is very non-transparent. Essentially, the candidates kind of play coy and they put their hat in the ring, but they don't really put their hat in the ring. It's very rare that you actually have formal announcements for candidates for Secretary General. There is the regional rotation, which I think that the member states are very reluctant to get. They all appreciate the idea that they will somehow get their turn at the at the helm, so to speak.
So you would agree with Juan Carlos, it must be changed.
Well, I just don't think that it's likely to be changed. I think that the Security Council enjoys its prerogatives, and they're going to continue to enforce those prerogatives. What you might see is maybe there's been suggested that the Security Council will offer several candidates and let the General Assembly sort of vote on their most favored candidate. But that would sort of be the process of an election without one, because they would all have to be approved by the Security Council anyway. So it's I think it would be more form over significance.
All right, let's go to Enoch in Greensboro, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Hello, Ms. Dan. How do you do today?
Fine, thank you, sir. Go right ahead.
Yes, ma'am. I'd like to say that I truly love your show, and I support it 100% of time. And thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, followed by a comment, or perhaps the other way around. My first question is if the UN has influential direct assets on the international courts, how come is only African leaders that seems to be trialed in the international courts? Having said so, being that the international court was once a slavery-held quarter, is this a continuity of a modern slavery? Second question is this. If the UN, by the way, does disperse justice equally, how much bias is it? Because it seems that to certain apply justice throughout the world, for me, there is a discrepancy in a level of applied justice.
All right, David.
So I think the caller is probably referring to the International Criminal Court, which was set up, negotiated in 1998, set up in 2000, began operating in 2002, and that court has the power to investigate and indict people for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Now, the ICC is not formally part of the UN system, so it's, you know, it has a separate budget and a separate leadership. But the caller is quite right that its investigations thus far have all been in Africa. And that leads to big questions about whether justice is being applied fairly. I think the court has been very careful about where it's done investigations, has tried thus far to avoid situations that are going to cause huge political friction for it, particularly with the most powerful states. And you can see that in places like Afghanistan or the Russia-Georgia conflict. These are places where the court has jurisdiction but has not decided to open full investigations. So that's been a big complaint against the court. It's something I think the court is trying to adjust to some degree, but it gets to this fundamental question about whether at the international level you can have impartial justice, or whether the political and power realities are simply too great.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Any comment, fellas?
Yeah, you know, I think that the caller raises an important point, that the politicization of all UN agencies does exist because it's an organization of governments. It's not an organization of people. That's why proposals for some kind of a United Nations parliament, an assembly where people would elect direct representation the way the European Parliament works, has been on the agenda for many, many years and has not gone anywhere in terms of being created. But I do think it's something, again, we in the United States should be taking the lead on this. The U.S. famously refused to vote for the creation of the International Criminal Court, said we are going to stand back from it, we're not going to support it. When President Clinton, at the very end of his term, signed on, he said, I know we're not going to be able to get approval in the Senate. And then President Bush, one of the first things he did was to, quote, unsign the Rome Treaty for the court. So what we need to do, I think, is go back to something that Justice Jackson, who was a U.S. Supreme Court judge and the lead prosecutor in Nuremberg, the first, arguably the first international court, when he said we have to be careful not to have victor's justice. And he said very explicitly we should have no law, no conviction. If an action is a crime, it must be a crime if we do it as much as if Germany does it. We should follow that model.
Final question for all of you, starting with you, Brett. How relevant would you say the United Nations is today compared to, say, 30 years ago?
think it's more relevant than it was 30 years ago. As David mentioned, particularly on matters of international peace and security, the Security Council was largely paralyzed during the Cold War. You see it be a lot more active today than it was then. You also see a lot more matters of political import in international discussions and international diplomacy raised in the General Assembly and in other UN forums. That being said, I also think it's a little bit less relevant than it was. As I mentioned earlier, today we have a proliferation of NGOs that are well-funded, that they have access all over the world in ways that they did not have access to before. We have more bilateral assistance, more multilateral assistance coming in that competes with these organizations. And I think there needs to be a reevaluation of a lot of the funds and programs and specialized agencies to focus in on those areas where they provide a unique contribution and sort of pare away and remove the areas where the gaps are being filled by NGOs and others.
Bill,
I think the UN is crucially important. We saw this during the period of decolonization, and we see it now. I don't think that the answer to the very real problems that we've identified is the further privatization of humanitarian assistance.
David.
I think the UN's relevance is going to depend greatly on the context. For example, the tensions in the East China Sea between Japan and China, very unlikely to be resolved through the UN. But other crises at certain moments, the UN can absolutely be central.
David Bosco of American University, Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, Brett Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation. Thank you all.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Urb-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts.